This is Joe Elia. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Our guest is Dr. Jerome P. Casera, author of a new autobiography, Unanticipated Outcomes, a Medical Memoir. Dr. Casera served as editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine for 8 years, from 1991 to 1999. Dr. Casera now serves as distinguished professor of medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine and also teaches medicine at Yale and Stanford. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Casera.
Nice to be with you again, Joe.
Let's start with medical journals in general. Your book offers a nice potted history of the NEJM, and Harlan Krumholtz himself, a friend of yours and editor of a circulation journal, last year wrote an essay accusing journals of being, among other things, too slow, too powerful, too focused on the wrong metrics. Do any of those criticisms resonate with your experience?
Well, of course, my experience was a long time ago when the pace of medical interventions was much different from what it is now. I respect Harlan Krumholtz's point of view. I think they're based in part on a lot of problems that have occurred in the 17 years since I left the journal. I think he's right that we're too slow. We don't share information as effectively as we can. We sometimes allow papers to be published that really should never see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some truth to what Harlan says.
Okay. A good deal of your book describes your conflicts over control of the journal's name and logo, the so-called meatball, among other things. And yet, in the end, you write that the publishers were, quote, simply doing their jobs as they saw fit. Are there lessons from those conflicts?
Well, of course, there are many lessons, one of which is something that I said actually in the book, which was that I could have been more accommodating. On the other hand, I felt quite strongly that the we had a gem of a publication.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was a very substantial difference of opinion between the people who own the journal, that is the Massachusetts Medical Society, and others like myself, who saw the journal not so much as a publication of the Mass Medical Society, but as belonging in part to the larger community mm-hmm. of physicians.
Yes.
Not just the academics, of course, but the researchers and the people who read the journal
mm-hmm.
and those who make their therapeutic decisions and diagnostic decisions based on what the journal publishes. So there was a culture difference. And the culture difference, in short, was whether or not the sale of the journal's name and the sale of the journal's logo were, in some sense, an exploitation. I felt that they were an exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
The medical society felt otherwise. And by and large, I mean, you have to face the fact that they own the journal. I didn't. I did have a great deal of what I think might be moral authority.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, in the final analysis, during my tenure, almost nothing happened that allowed that exploitation. In fact, even for many years afterward.
Mm-hmm.
They laid off trying to exploit the journal's name.
Uh-huh. You write that you suspect part of the problem was your editorializing against the AMA. And you say that you've come to that recently.
That's correct. In fact, it was really kind of bizarre. When I left the journal, nobody stopped me from taking papers that I had in my possession. Mm-hmm. None of it was marked confidential.
Yeah.
And except for one, there was one document that was marked confidential, and I never used that.
Uh-huh.
But I had plenty of other material, and after 13 years, it was sitting there, and I finally decided, well, I better pick it up and look at it, because otherwise I'm going to throw it all out. So I spent about 2 years digging through every document that I had, and finally came to the realization that at least the sequence of time events was such that there was at least a credible idea that my criticism of the AMA had something to do with my departure. By the way, you mentioned that I was let go. I was actually fired.
Uh-huh.
In a very clever sort of way, which is not worth talking about at all anymore.
Okay.
But the time sequence was such that I began to get a lot of criticism within days after my first editorial criticizing the AMA. I can't even remember now what the criticism was.
Uh-huh.
But then over a period of about 2 years, I wrote four editorials, not all myself. I wrote them with
Marcia.
The executive editor, Marcia Angel.
Yeah.
Then I wrote four of them, all critical of the AMA, one time for what I thought was reducing the quality of certification, one time for making a mistake of trying to sell products.
Yes.
And so forth. And then the 4 days after my fourth editorial, I was fired. So in putting all the time sequence together, that was the first thing that brought it to my attention. But then I went back, and once I had that idea in mind, then I went back and looked at what the arrangements had been between the officers of the medical society and the AMA. And to my astonishment, I found that they were all very, very closely connected at the AMA. So my presumption was that that may have been part of the reason I was let go.
Okay. As I said at the beginning, I was working there at the time. I had, as you know, spent 10 years at the journal itself, and so I keep an ear to the ground on these things. And we were together in some Committee on Publications meetings. I have to observe that in all of the years, I've never heard anyone say anything against your editorials. And so it may be that some of these things were in the air. I think though that was not. I think when you wrote that some of these, and I'm quoting you, some of these opposing issues seem quite a lot less important today than they did then, but these issues and others dominated my interactions with the societies, especially after 1997. I believe that the officers and staff of the society overreacted but so did I. I can be a stubborn old coot.
And right. I think you can look at that memoir and see, and many people who've read the book have said that it sounds very much like me when I talk.
Yeah. Right.
Judge for yourself. By the way, as far as criticism of my editorials, quite the opposite.
Really?
When I heard from the officers of the AMA, of the Mass Medical Society, all along was that they loved what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
And yet they decided to let me go.
All right.
But again, it's water over the bridge.
Or under the bridge, or over the dam, or something. Well, your predecessor at Neachem was Arnold Relman, who warned about the rise of what he called the new medical industrial complex in a long special article. And he warned that healthcare would become a commodity. And you followed during your tenure with many editorials of your own on this topic. Is there one editorial that you would consider, Jerry Kassirer's signature editorial that you would like people to read today?
Well, I think the one that I got a lot of attention was one called Managed Care and the Morality of the Marketplace.
Uh-huh.
That was one that I think pretty much put the perspective on what then was a beginning effort to manage care in a very clumsy way.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to put the kibosh on it from the editorial perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think another one was a paper I wrote about around 1998, it was called The Next Transformation in the Delivery of Medical Care.
Uh-huh.
And in that one, I predicted what the internet and email would be doing to medical care, and a lot of that has come to fruition. But in terms of the one that I think might be the most interest over the long run, it might be that managed care article. I wrote actually five editorials about managed care. I was so concerned about the way it was evolving at the time.
Yeah, you talk about the conflict of interest that the clinician has there, where between looking out for their employment and trying to manage costs, and then all most importantly, doing the best for the patient.
In fact, the essence of that article was that it put the clinician in an extremely difficult position of needing to make a decent income. And then even shortchanging the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that put them in a morally very difficult position.
Uh-huh. Your interest in clinical decision-making and the process of coming to a diagnosis, which I was thinking a kind of like medical epistemology, how do you know what you know, seem hallmarks of your academic life. And you mentioned near the end of your book the fear that newer generation clinicians may be losing the ability to think problems through. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. Long before I went to the journal, I was very much interested in the process of diagnosis and the decisions that physicians make, in particular the trade-offs between the risks and benefits of tests and treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when I came to the journal, one of the things that was immediately apparent to me was that the the clinical aspects of the journal had gone kind of cold.
Mm-hmm.
The science was great. The issues about healthcare were terrific, but there wasn't much of a clinical focus. So I introduced two features: clinical problem solving and images in clinical medicine. And that became, both of them became wildly popular, especially the latter.
Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time thinking about clinical reasoning when I was at the journal, though I didn't publish a whole lot about it myself. When I left the journal, though, I redid the second edition of a book that I did, just that I published just before I went to the journal, called Learning Clinical Reasoning.
Uh-huh.
And so I rekindled my work on how clinicians think about diagnosis and treatment. So, but then in my experience after the journal, when I was spending a lot of time teaching clinical medicine to residents at Tufts, at Stanford and Yale,
mm-hmm.
I became concerned that the technology that they were using was potentially robbing them of their basic knowledge, because they were relying on looking up information and immediately, and the information comes and goes, and it doesn't stick.
Yeah.
So I was likening it to the way I used to learn telephone numbers, and after I got a cell phone, I couldn't remember telephone number of my brother, and because I didn't need it anymore.
Right.
And so I wrote a article about this. I published it in The Lancet a couple years after I left the journal, making the point that clinical reasoning depends a lot on knowledge.
Uh-huh.
And to the extent that you don't accumulate the knowledge, you're not going to be able to do the reasoning.
Uh-huh. When you think back on the rhythms, you think back the 17 years on the rhythms of a weekly journal. How would you describe them to an aspiring editor? Was it did it seem frenetic or like a busy day in the clinic, or was there a metaphor that you often use to describe it to friends and family when they say, "Well, why are you working again this weekend, Jerry?"
Well, first of all, I think I differed a lot from my predecessor in one major respect. Bud Relman was a fantastic editor, perhaps one of the best editors of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at every manuscript and puzzled about it and worried about it and made every possible judgment. I didn't do that.
Uh-huh.
I saw my job differently. I had a staff of absolutely first-class people to look at the manuscripts. I had deputy editors. I had associate editors. I had outstanding reviewers. And I thought that they probably were even better at examining manuscript after another than I was. And not that I didn't pay attention to every paper at the end, I did, but I didn't obsess over every single manuscript. Instead, I paid attention to other things,
yeah,
like developing new features for the journal,
right?
Like putting in an internet system, a website.
Right.
Like developing series on the healthcare system of the United States at the time,
right,
and things like that. So I saw myself as in a kind of a different role than Bud did,
right?
And not that he did anything that I thought was inferior. I thought his was superb. But I just had took my role
as his production editor. I do remember Bud's keeping manuscripts overly long, and I was delighted when you came and you reinstituted the practice of measuring how long it took for a manuscript to go through the system, and as you said, as you mentioned in the book, you cut the time down by at least a third, and it probably still has dropped from there.
Well, that's right. I mean, the way I did it was pretty straightforward. I just, instead of sending a manuscript out blindly and hoping that someone would look at it, I'd get in touch with them to make sure that they were willing to do it.
Yeah.
And then that enormously shortened the time that manuscripts were out. But then, of course, that was before that was before email.
Right.
Now you just ship off a manuscript electronically, and it's with the author one day, the editor the next day, and the reviewer the next day. So that really shortens the time enormously.
Yeah, and you may know that Bud was famous for not turning on his computer ever, even when he got one.
He sat there in the corner drawing.
You know, you came to medicine almost accidentally, you write, and your first love until you got sidetracked by a course in mechanics was you wanted to be a nuclear physicist. Any regrets about not being a nuclear physicist as you'd first planned? I can't imagine you have any.
Well, I'm in the middle of reading a wonderful book about Albert Einstein.
Uh-huh.
And when I read the kind of insights that Einstein had and the kind of plebeian ideas that I had about physics, all I can say is I got very lucky that I went into medicine.
And I think the rest of us did too. Finally, I just want to make sure that people know how to get hold of your book, which is Unanticipated Outcomes is the title. Is it available only on Amazon Kindle?
No. There's a hardcover book.
Okay.
Available through my website. It's a simple JeromeCassier.com.
Okay.
All one word, JeromeCassier.com.
Okay.
And you can order the book through PayPal just by using any credit card.
Okay.
Or you can actually, if you want, my address is on there. They can send me a check, and I'll get the book in the mail right away.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you again.
Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure. I remember with some great pleasure working not only with you, but with many of your colleagues there. I always had a good relationship with the staff, and I look back at my time at the Journal with great pleasure.
Yeah.
And so good luck there.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're lucky to have you.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay. Obviously, Dr. Cassirer's opinions and the matters we've discussed are his own. That was our 210th edition. All earlier conversations may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch. Kristen Kelly is the executive producer here for the NEJM Group. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.